than nights in the woods, but he stepped back and left her alone to warm herself by the flames. It was not a cold day, but shock could make one shiver down to one's bones. The light from the flames danced over the William Morris wallpaper and the deep colours of the Axminster rugs that covered the wooden floor. At last, Grace rose to her feet and began to pace up and down in front of the fire. She had pulled the last pins from her hair, and it streamed over her shoulders like icy water. Grace, now in this room, with only the sound of the ticking clock breaking the silence, James hesitated, as he had not had time or pause to do in the infirmary. Can you speak of what happened? Where was the attack? How did you escape?
Mama was attacked at the manor, said Grace, her voice flat. I do not know how it happened. I found her unconscious at the bottom of the front steps. The wounds in her shoulder and arm were the wounds of teeth.
I am so sorry.
You don't have to say that, said Grace. She had begun to pace again. There are things you don't know, James, and things I must do now that she is sick, before she wakes.
I am glad you think she will recover, said James, coming close to her. He was not sure if he should reach to touch her, even as she stopped pacing and raised her eyes to his. He did not think he had seen Grace like this before. It is important to have hope.
It is certainty. My mother will not die, said Grace. All these years she has lived on bitterness, and her bitterness will keep her alive now. It is stronger than death.
She reached to caress his face. He closed his eyes as her fingertips traced the contour of his cheekbone, light as the touch of a dragonfly's wing.
James, she said. Oh, James, open your eyes. Let me look at you while you still love me.
His eyes flew open.
I have loved you for years. I will always love you.
No, said Grace, dropping her hand. There was a great weariness on her face, in her movements.
You will hate me soon.
I could never hate you, James said.
I am getting married, she said.
It was the sort of shock so immense one hardly felt it. She's made some kind of mistake, James thought. She's confused. I will fix this.
I will be marrying Charles, she went on. Charles Fairchild. We have been spending quite a bit of time together since I came to London, though I know you have not noticed it.
A pulse had started to pound behind James's eyes, in time with the ticking of the grandfather clock. This is madness, Grace. You asked me to marry you last night.
And you said no. You were very clear.
She gave a slight shrug.
Charles said yes.
Charles is engaged to Ariadne Bridgestock.
That engagement is broken. Charles told Inquisitor Bridgestock he was ending it this morning. Ariadne did not love Charles. She will not care whether they marry or not.
Really? Did you ask her? James demanded fiercely, and Grace flinched. None of this makes sense, Grace. You've been in London less than a week. Her eyes glittered.
I can get a great deal accomplished in less than a week.
Apparently, including harming Ariadne Bridgestock, who has never done anything to you. Charles is a cold person. He has a cold heart. But I would have expected better from you than to be a party to something like this. Grace flushed.
You think Ariadne is desperate? She is beautiful and rich, and Charles is prepared to tell everyone she broke it off with him.
While she was unconscious.
Clearly he will say it was before she fell ill, Grace snapped.
And if she dies, how convenient for you, said James, pain like a white flare behind his eyes.
I told you that you would hate me, said Grace,
and there was something almost savage in her expression.
I tell you, she does not want Charles, and if she dies, yes, she will need him even less than she does now.
She gasped for breath.
You cannot see it. I am more desperate than Ariadne could ever be.
I cannot see what you will not tell me, said James in a low voice.
If you are desperate, let me help you. I offered you the chance to help me, she said. I asked you to marry me, but you would not have it. Everything you have here, it is all more important to you than I am.
That's not true.
She laughed sharply. To love me, James, you must love me above all other things. We will forever be my mother's target if we marry, and then our children will be. And how could that be worth it to you? I already know it is not. When I asked you to marry me last night, it was only a test. I wished to see if you loved me enough to do anything to protect me. You do not.
And Charles does. James's voice was low. You barely know him.
It doesn't matter. Charles has power. He will be the consul. He does not need to love me.
She faced him across the worn pattern of the carpet.
I must do this now before my mother wakes. She would forbid it. But if she wakes and it is done, she will not go against the Clave and consul. Don't you see? It is impossible between us, James.
It is only impossible if you make it so, said James. Grace drew her shawl around her shoulders as if she were cold.
You do not love me enough, she said. You will realize that soon and be grateful I have done this.
She held her hand out.
Please return my bracelet to me. It was like the lash of a whip.
Slowly, James reached for the clasp of the silver circlet. It had rested there so long that when he removed it, he saw a strip of paler flesh circling his wrist, like the pallor left behind when a wedding ring was removed. Grace, he said, holding it out to her, you don't need to do this. She took the bracelet from him, leaving his wrist feeling unnaturally bare.
What we had was the dream of children, she said. It will fade like snow in summer. You will forget.
His head felt as if his skull were cracking. He could barely breathe. He heard his own voice as if it came from a long distance away.
I am a Herondale. We love but once. That is only a story.
Haven't you heard? James said bitterly. All the stories are true. He flung the door open, desperate to get away from her. As he raced down the hall, the faces of strangers flew by in a blur. He heard his own name called, and then he was down the stairs and in the entryway, seizing up his coat. The sky was cloudy overhead, and shadows had gathered thickly in the courtyard, resting among the branches of the trees like ravens.
Jamie!
Matthew appeared out of the dimness, his hair bright in the dark entryway, his expression concerned.
Jamie, what's wrong?
Grace is marrying Charles, said James. Let it be, Math. I need to be alone.
Before Matthew could say a word, James threw open the doors and fled, vanishing beneath the arched gates that marked the entrance to the Institute, the words carved on them gleaming in the dull sunlight. We are dust and shadows. Matthew swore, his fingers fumbling at the buttons of his coat. James had just vanished into the shadows outside the Institute without a single weapon on him, but Matthew was sure he could catch him up. He knew James's haunts as well as James knew them himself, all the places in the city James might seek out when he was upset. His hands were shaking too badly to get the buttons right, though. He swore again and reached for the flask in his waistcoat. Just a nip to steady his hands and put him to rights.
Was James... Did he seem all right? Said a voice behind him.
Matthew turned, dropping his hand. Grace stood at the foot of the steps, a grey shawl like a spider's web wrapped around her thin shoulders. Matthew knew she was thought strikingly beautiful by most, but she had always seemed like the shadow of a shadow to him, lacking vibrancy and colour.
Of course he isn't all right, Matthew said.
Neither am I. You're marrying Charles, and none of us wants that.
She pulled the shawl tighter about herself. You don't understand. We all do what we must. I am doing what I have to do.
James has loved you, sincerely, since he was a child, said Matthew. And now you tear his heart to pieces. And for what? Charles will never feel half of what James feels for you.
Feelings, she said with contempt. That is all men think women want, isn't it? Sympathy, sentiment, nonsense. I have never felt any tenderness for anything or anyone living.
Have you truly never felt anything for anyone? Matthew demanded, half angry and half curious.
She was silent for a long moment. My brother, she said at last, with a peculiar half-smile. But then, he is not now living.
So you never cared for James at all, he said, full realization dawning slowly. Has James disappointed you in some way, or were you just tired of him before you even came to London? All the time you've spent with Charles, all the bloody carriage rides, all the whispering in corners, Lord, you planned this like a military campaign, didn't you? If the first regiment falls, you always have a replacement at the ready.
He laughed bitterly.
I told myself I was a fool for being suspicious that you were going behind James's back. I didn't imagine half the truth.
She looked paler than usual. You would not be wise to spread such rumours. Let it be, Matthew.
I cannot.
He started in on his coat again. Oddly, his hands were steady, as if anger had flattened his nerves.
Charles is a bastard, but even he doesn't deserve...
Matthew, she said, coming closer and laying her hand on his elbow. He paused in surprise, looking at her face upturned to his. He could see that the shape of it was indeed lovely, almost doll-like in its perfection. She stroked her hand down his sleeve. He told himself he should pull back from her, but his feet seemed rooted to the floor. It was as if he were being drawn toward her, though he hated her at the same time. You feel something for me now, don't you? Said Grace. Kiss me. I demand that you do. As if in a dream, Matthew reached for her. He grasped Grace's slim waist in his hands. He pressed his hungry mouth against her lips and kissed her and kissed her. She tasted of sweet tea and oblivion. He felt nothing. No desire, no yearning, only an empty, desperate compulsion. He kissed her mouth and her cheek, and she turned in his arms, still holding his wrist, her body against his. And then she stepped back, releasing him. It was like waking from a dream. He flinched back in horror, stumbling away from Grace. There was nothing timid in that glance, nothing of the girl with her face downcast at the ball. The colour of her eyes had turned to steel. You, he began and broke off. He couldn't say what he wanted to say. You made me do that. It was ludicrous, a bizarre abdication of personal responsibility for an even more bizarre act. When she spoke, her voice held no emotion. Her lips were red where he had kissed her. He felt like being sick. If you get in my way after this, if you do anything to impede my marriage to Charles, I will tell James you kissed me, and I will tell your brother too. As if they do not already know I am a terrible person, he said, with a bravado he did not feel. Oh, Matthew. Her voice was cold as she turned away from him. You have no idea what terrible people are like.
13. Blue Ruin. 20 bridges from tower to quay wanted to know what the river knew, but they were young and the Thames was old, and this is the tale that the river told. Rudyard Kipling, The River's Tale.
James sat on the edge of a stone bastion atop Blackfriars Bridge, his legs dangling over the edge. The dark jade water of the Thames flowed by below. Small rowboats and lighters chugged alongside river barges, distinguished by their characteristic red-brown sails, like splotches of blood against the cloud-darkened sky. Aboard them, men in flat caps yelled to each other through the river spray. To the north, the dome of St. Paul's glowed against a backdrop of thunderclouds. On the other side of the river, the Bankside power station puffed black smoke into the sky. The rhythmic slap of the tidal river against the granite piers of the bridge was as familiar to James as a lullaby. Blackfriars was a special place in his family. It figured in quite a few of his parents' stories. He usually found it comforting here. The river rolled on, regardless of the turmoil in the lives of the people who crossed the bridge or boated across the water. They could leave no real mark on the river, as their troubles left no real mark on time. Now it was not comforting. Now he did not feel as if he could breathe. The pain he felt was physical, as if sharp steel rods had been slid through his ribs, stopping his heart. James? James glanced up. Matthew was walking toward him, his top coat open. He was hatless, fair hair tangled in the breeze off the river, scented with coal and salt. "I have been looking for you all over the city," Matthew said, swinging himself up on the stone bastion beside James. James fought the urge to tell him to be careful. It was a long fall to the river, but Matthew's hands were steady as he braced himself. "Tell me what happened." James couldn't explain it. The choking feeling, the dizziness. He recalled his father saying that love was pain, but this felt other than pain. It felt as if he had been deprived of air, almost to the point of death, and now was gasping and choking on it, trying desperately to get enough into his lungs. He couldn't find words, couldn't do anything but lean over and put his head down on Matthew's shoulder. "Jamie, Jamie," Matthew said, and his hand came up to press itself strongly against James's back between his shoulder blades. "Don't." James kept his face pressed into the tweed of Matthew's coat. It smelled like brandy and the Penhaligon's cologne Matthew nicked from Charles. James knew his body was bent in a somewhat awkward way, his hand gripping Matthew's shirt front, and his face jammed into his shoulder, but there was something about the comfort of your parabatai. No one else could give it to you. Not mother or sister or father or lover. It was a transcendence of all that. People were wont to dismiss Matthew, because of his clothes, because of his jokes, because of the way he took nothing seriously. They assumed he was liable to break, to give way when things became difficult. But he wasn't. He was holding James up now, as he always had, and making it look easy, as he always had. "I suppose there are a lot of useless things I could tell you," he said in a low voice, as James drew back. "That it was probably better this happened sooner, that it is better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all, and all that. But that's all rot, isn't it?" "Most likely," said James. He was aware his hands were shaking in a way that reminded him of something. He couldn't quite recall what. He was having trouble focusing, ideas skittering about like mice diving away from an approaching cat. "I thought my life would be one thing. Now it seems it is to be entirely different." Matthew screwed up his face in a way parents often found adorable. James thought it made him look like Oscar. "Believe me," he said, "I do know how that feels." James was slightly surprised to hear it. He'd walked in on Matthew in compromising positions before with girls and boys, but he'd never thought Matthew's heart was engaged with any of them. There was Lucy, of course, but James suspected that Matthew did not love her either, beyond the remnants of a childhood infatuation. Somewhere along the way, James sensed, Matthew had lost faith in most things. It would be easy for him to keep his faith in Lucy, but faith alone was not love. James reached his hand into Matthew's coat. Matthew grumbled but didn't slap his hand away as James unbuttoned the inside pocket and drew out his parabatized silver flask.
"Are you sure?" said Matthew.
"The last time you were feeling heartbroken, you took shots at a chandelier with a mundane gun and nearly drowned yourself in the Serpentine."
"I wasn't trying to drown myself," James pointed out. "Besides, Magnus Baines saved me."
"Don't mention that," said Matthew, as James uncapped the flask. "You know how angry I am about that. I idolize Magnus Baines. You had one chance to meet him and you embarrassed us all."
"I'm quite sure I never mentioned any of you to him," said James and tipped the flask back. He choked. It was Blue Ruin, the cheapest, harshest kind of gin. It went down like lightning. He coughed and thrust the flask away.
"Even worse," said Matthew. "How sharper than the serpent's tooth it is to have an ungrateful parabatai."
"I'm fairly sure that isn't the original Shakespeare," James said. "It was a good thing Bane was there," he added. "I was in a bad state, I barely recall it.
I know it was because of Grace. She had written to me to say we should cut off contact with each other. I couldn't understand it. I went out to drink, to forget."
He broke off, shaking his head. "The next day she wrote to me again to apologize. She said she had only been frightened.
I wonder now if it would have been better had things ended then. We do not get to choose when in our lives we feel pain," said Matthew. "It comes when it comes, and we try to remember, even though we cannot imagine a day when it will release its hold on us, that all pain fades. All misery passes. Humanity is drawn to light, not darkness."
The sky was full of London's black smoke. Matthew was a pale mark against the storm-dark sky. The bright fabric of his waistcoat shone, as did his fair hair.
"Math," James said, "I know you never liked Grace."
Matthew sighed.
"It doesn't matter what I think of her. It never did."
"You knew she didn't love me," James said. He still felt dizzy.
"No, I feared it. It is not the same. Even then, I could never have guessed what she would do. Charles will never make her happy."
"She asked me to marry her last night, to run away and marry her in secret," said James.
"I said no. Today she told me it had been a test. It was as if she had decided that our love was already a broken and ruined thing and was trying to prove it."
He took a ragged breath.
"But I cannot imagine loving her more than I have. More than I do."
Matthew's fingers whitened where he grasped the flask. After a long moment, he spoke with some difficulty.
"You cannot torment yourself," he said. "If it had not been that test, it would have been another. This is not an issue of love, but of ambition. She wishes to be the consul's wife. Love has no place in this plan."
James tried to focus on Matthew's face. It wasn't as easy as it ought to have been. Lights danced behind his eyelids when he closed them, and his hands were still shaking. Surely this could not be from one sip of Blue Ruin. He knew he wasn't drunk, but a feeling of detachment was still there, as if nothing he did now mattered.
"Tell me, Matthew," he said. "Tell me the name of the shadow that is always hanging over you. I can become a shadow. I could fight it for you."
Matthew squeezed his eyes shut as if in pain.
"Oh, Jamie," he sighed. "What if I said there is no shadow?"
"I would not believe you," said James. "I know what I feel in my own heart."
"James," said Matthew, "you're starting to slide off the bridge."
"Good." James closed his eyes. "Maybe I'll be able to sleep tonight."
Matthew leaped down, just in time to catch James as he slumped backward off the wall. James knelt upon the roof of the Institute. He knew that he was dreaming, yet at the same time it felt impossible that what was happening to him was not real. He could see London laid out before him as clearly as a painting, see its roads and alleys and boulevards, see the stars hanging high above the city, pale white as the pearly teeth of a child's doll. He could see himself as from a distance, see the black of his hair and the deeper black of the wings that rose from his back. He saw himself struggle with the weight of the wings. They were jagged and dark, with overlapping layers of feathers that shaded from deep black to grey. He realised then they were not his wings. A monster knelt on his back, a creature whose face he could not see. A humped, misshapen thing in pale grey rags, its sharp talons dug deep into his back. He felt the pain. It was as fierce as fire burning through his skin. He staggered to his feet, twisting and turning as if he could hurl the creature off him. Light blazed up all around him, pale gold light, the same light he had seen when he'd passed into the Shadow Realm and then into the Chiswick greenhouse. The light of Cortana. He saw her there, the blade in her hand, her hair like fire. She cut at the creature on James's back, and with a searing pain it tore away from him. Cortana sunk deep into its body. It fell away, tumbling down the steep incline of the roof. James's shirt was rags, soaked in blood. He could feel more blood trickling between his shoulder blades. Cordelia ran to him. She whispered his name, James, James, as if no one had ever spoken it before. All about them the sky bloomed with brilliant lights. He could no longer see Cordelia. The lights formed into shapes and patterns. He had seen them before, the scrawls on the paper in Garst's flat. The knowledge of what they were tickled at the edge of his brain. He called out for Cordelia, but she was gone, like the dream he'd known she was. When James woke in the morning, he was lying in his own bed. He was fully dressed, though someone had taken off his jacket and shoes and set them on a chair. In a velvet wing-backed chair nearby, Matthew was dozing, his cheek propped on his hand. Matthew always looked quite different when he was asleep. The constant motion that was such a distraction when he was awake vanished, and he became one of those paintings he loved, a Frederick Leighton, perhaps. Leighton was famous for painting children in their innocence, and when Matthew slept, he looked as if sorrow had never touched him. As if he knew he was being watched, he stirred and sat up, focusing on James. "You're awake," he began to grin. "How's your head? Ringing like a bell?" James sat up slowly. He had been with Matthew on many mornings when his parabatai was complaining of a bad head, or aches and misery, and the need to swallow a glass of raw egg and pepper before he could face the day. But James felt nothing like that. Nothing hurt or ached. "No, but how do I look?" "Ghastly," Matthew reported happily. "Like you saw the ghost of old Moll and your hair's still sticking up." James stared down at his own hands, turning them over. His bare wrists still looked odd, the bracelet's absence like a glaring wound. But there was no actual pain, either physical or mental. "On the other hand," Matthew said, his eyes diabolically alight, "I can't say your parents were too pleased when I carried you in last night." James bolted out of bed. His clothes were as rumpled as if he'd slept under a bridge. "You carried me? My parents were here?" "They had indeed come back from their meeting with my brother," said Matthew, "who was apparently very boring, which I could have told them."
"Matthew," James said.
Matthew held up his hands innocently. "I said nothing to them, but apparently Charles told them of his engagement to Grace at the meeting, and they deduced you were trying to drown your sorrows. I told them that you'd only had a sip of gin, and they decried you as a lightweight."
"Dear God."
James staggered to the washroom. Thankfully, there was water in the pitcher and a bar of sandalwood soap. He scrubbed himself down hastily and rinsed his hair. Feeling less revolting, he went into the dressing room, threw on new clothes and returned to the bedroom, where Matthew sat on the foot of his bed with his legs crossed. He handed James a mug of tea without a word, exactly the way he liked it, strong and sugared, with no milk. "Where did you produce that from?" James wondered aloud, accepting the mug. Matthew hopped to his feet. "Come along," he said. "Food has been laid on in the breakfast room. Let us sample some of Bridget's delicious eggs and I'll explain." James eyed his parabatai with suspicion. Bridget's eggs were famously awful. "Explain what?" Matthew made a hushing gesture. Rolling his eyes, James slid his feet into shoes and followed Matthew through the winding corridors to the breakfast room, where food was still laid out. A silver urn with now cold coffee in it, plates of veal chops, and James's least favourite, kedgeree. He settled at the table with a plate of mushrooms and toast. His mind felt surprisingly clear, as if he had come out of a strange fog. Even the toast and mushrooms tasted different. He frowned. "Something's happened," he said, realizing how quiet it was. Only the sound of clocks ticking in the institute. The corridors had been devoid of people. He stood and went to the window which looked out over the courtyard. It was empty of carriages. His grip tightened on the sill. "Matthew, has anyone..." "No," Matthew said quickly. "No, Jamie, no one else has died. The Enclave decided to move the wounded to the Silent City. They were too ill to be portaled there, so your parents are helping with the task, as are Christopher's. Even Charles has loaned our carriage." "And Grace?" said James. Her name felt odd in his mouth, as if it had acquired a new sound. He remembered the sick pain he had felt the day before, propelling him out into the dark. A feeling as if his chest were cracking apart, his bones splintering. He did not feel it now. He remembered the pain, but intellectually, not physically. It would surely come back, he thought. He should brace himself while he could. "The Pouncebys have taken her in," said Matthew. "They are in Highgate, near the entrance to the Silent City. She will be able to visit her mother." He paused. "She will be all right, James." "Yes, I trust she will," said James. "And Lucy? Does she know what's going on?" Matthew looked surprised. "Yes, but did you hear what I said of Grace?" Before James could answer, Lucy came into the dining room. She was in training clothes, a soft, belted tunic over leggings and boots, and she carried a handful of letters with her. The post must just have come. She dropped the correspondence into the mail salver on the bureau and came towards James with a worried look.
"Jamie! Oh, thank goodness. Mother told me about Charles and Grace, but I have kept the news entirely to myself. Are you all right? Is your soul harrowed?"
"Cruel Prince Jamie is quite all right, thank you," he said. Rather oddly, he noticed, Matthew had slid around behind Lucy and appeared to be poking at the mail. "Where have you been, Luce?"
"Up in the training room with Cordelia," she said. "Alistair went with Charles to help move some of the sick, and she stayed back with me. We thought perhaps we ought to be a bit more prepared, you know, in case you have another secret assignation that ends in a demon attack."
"I don't think that's likely," James said, and saw Matthew give him yet another peculiar look.
"James," said Lucy severely, "you do not need to pretend to be brave, as Lord Wingrave was when his hand was rejected in marriage."
James wondered if this was someone he was supposed to know.
"Who on earth's that?" "He's in The Beautiful Cordelia," Lucy said. "I swear I read that bit out loud last Christmas. Papa was very impressed."
Matthew whirled around, his hands behind his back.
"Ah, Lucy," he said a little too loudly. "You have been training, I see, like a great warrior of England, like Boadicea, who defeated the Romans. Sit down. Let me make you a honey sandwich."
Lucy looked hesitant, then seemed to shrug and accept the gesture.
You are a mad person, Matthew, she said. But I do adore honey sandwiches.
She flopped down in a chair and reached for the teapot.
I suppose Charles and Grace haven't announced their engagement formally yet, but that would be awfully rude of them with Ariadne so ill. I am surprised the Inquisitor hasn't tried to get Charles arrested.
As Matthew crossed the room to get the honey pot from the sideboard, he pressed something flat and papery into James's hand.
I know it's addressed to Lucy, he said in a low voice, but it's for Cordelia. Take it to her.
One did not ask questions when one's parabatai made a request.
It seems I have forgotten to put on socks, James announced.
Lucy stared at him as if he'd lost his wits. He edged toward the door, trying to prevent Lucy from seeing his feet.
I shall return in a moment.
James took the stairs toward the upper floors two at a time. He felt lighter than he had in months, as if he had put down a massive burden he hadn't even known he was carrying. As he reached the third floor landing, he examined the object that Matthew had handed him, a letter, addressed in the consul's unmistakable handwriting, to Lucy Herondale. The door of the training room was open. It was a large room, which had been made larger a few years ago, when they had joined it up with the rest of the attic. The floor was polished wood covered in tatami mats, and flexible ropes dangled from the raftered beams overhead, knotted at various lengths to make for easier climbing. Witchlight torches lit the room, and cloudy sunlight poured in through the windows high above. Cordelia stood at the north end of the room in front of the large silvered mirror, Cortana gleaming gold in her hand. She wore training clothes she must have borrowed from Lucy. They were tight and short on her, her ankles visible beneath the hems of the trousers. She turned, moving with the sword as if they danced together. Her light brown skin gleamed in the witchlight, sheened with sweat at her collarbones, her throat. Her hair had come free from its pins. It tumbled down her back like a waterfall of autumn leaves. Together, she and Cortana were a poem written in fire and blood. He must have made a noise, for she turned to look at him, eyes wide, her chest rising and falling with quick breaths. A jolt went through him, something like a memory. Cordelia lying beside him, her hair soft against the side of his neck, the warmth of her hip against his. He tried to shake the thought from his head. Nothing like that had ever happened in his life. A fragment of his dream the night before, perhaps. He drew the letter from his pocket and held it out to her. Daisy, he said, I have something for you. Many years of practice had acquainted Cordelia well with solo training. Her father had always said that a living partner was necessary to learn certain aspects of sword art. How could you learn to turn a blade at close quarters, for instance, if you had no opposing sword to press yours against? Alistair had retorted that Shadowhunter training was somewhat unique. You were rarely fighting another opponent with a sword after all, and far more often a peculiarly shaped monster. Cordelia had giggled, and Elias had rolled his eyes and relented. After all, they moved around so often for Elias's health that neither Cordelia nor Alistair had regular training partners except each other, and they did not match in height or weight. So when Lucy had gone off to procure herself a cup of tea, Cordelia had fallen into the old patterns of practicing her footwork, lunging with Cortana in hand, practicing sequences of actions over and over, until they were as natural to her as walking downstairs. She raised Cortana, turned, spun, and lunged, only to nearly lose her balance in surprise as James walked through the open door of the training room. She stared at him for a moment, caught off guard. Something about him seemed different. His clothes were ordinary, morning coat, grey trousers, and his hair was the usual dark tangle. There were slight shadows under his eyes, which was unsurprising for someone who had been out late. She slid Cortana into the sheath at her back as James drew a letter from his pocket and offered it to her with a smile, She could see Lucy's name scrawled across the front. "How did you know this was for me?" she asked. Her hands were shaking as she took the letter from him and began to open it. "Matthew told me," he said. "I believe he is distracting Lucy in the dining room, though who knows how long that will last." "It's all right, you know. I trust Lucy," Cordelia said. "If I hadn't been prepared for her to read the letter, I wouldn't have had it sent here." "I know," said James. "But it is your letter. Why shouldn't you read it first? In fact, if you'd like me to leave, I can."
"No,"
Cordelia said, dropping her gaze to scan Charlotte's scrawled lines.
"No, do please stay."
"Dear Lucy, I hope this letter finds you well, and dear Cordelia also. I am afraid that I only have a little bit of news, as the situation with Elias Carstairs has been put on hold while the current emergency is dealt with. We did indeed attempt to try Elias by the mortal sword, but unfortunately doing so did not shed any light on the situation, as Elias has no memory of the events of the night of the battle. It is a very complicated matter. Please give Cordelia my best wishes. I look forward to returning to London and seeing you soon. Love, Charlotte." Cordelia sat down hard on the windowsill.
"I don't understand," she whispered. "Why wouldn't he remember?"
James crinkled his eyebrows. "What do you mean? What's happened?"
"You know, my father is soon to be on trial," she said slowly, "in Idris."
"Yes," he said. "I have not wanted to pry. I have not even asked Lucy for details, though I was curious." He sat down beside her on the windowsill.
"I will not lie," he said. "I have heard whispers, but I put little stock in whispers. There have been enough about me and my family, and enough of them untrue, for me to prefer my own judgment to that of others."
He laid his hand over hers. "If you want to share the truth with me, I would be glad to hear it. But it is your choice, Daisy." His fingers were warm and calloused, rough with scars.
James seemed different, Cordelia thought again, more present, as if he were here in the moment, not holding the world at arm's length.
The whole story came pouring out of her. Her father's illness over the past years, necessitating their many moves from place to place. His agreeing to help with the expedition, the disaster that had followed, his arrest, their journey to London, the upcoming trial, Cordelia's attempts to find a way to save her family.
"Matthew was kind enough to arrange for me to get this letter, but it is another dead end. I don't know how to help my father."
James looked thoughtful. "Daisy, I'm so sorry. This is something that your friends should be helping you with, and I am one of them."
"There is nothing anyone can do," Cordelia said.
For the first time, she felt hopeless about her father.
"Not necessarily," said James.
"Considering who my parabatized mother is, I hear more about the legal processes of the Clave than I might prefer. I can tell you that if this is going to be a trial with no mortal sword, it will have to rely on testimony and character witnesses."
"Character witnesses? But my father knows so few people," Cordelia said. "We have always been moving, never even at Sirenworth for long stretches of time."
"I've heard many stories about your father," James went on, "mostly from Jem. After Jem's parents were killed by the demon Yenlo, it was Elias who tracked the demon down with Ker Yiwen and slew it, saving countless lives. Your father may have been weary and sick these last few years, but before that he was a hero, and the Clave needs to be reminded of that." Hope began to return to Cordelia's heart.
"My father rarely talks about his life before our family. Do you think you could help me find out the names of some of these witnesses? Though," she added hastily, "I understand if you can't. I know Grace will need you now with her mother ill."
James hesitated. "I no longer have an understanding with Grace."
"What?"
He had drawn his hands back. They were trembling. She realized with a slight shock that the metal cuff was no longer on his wrist. Grace must have taken it back. You're the first person I've told, aside from Matthew. Last night, Christopher exploded into the room like a small cyclone. He was hatless and wore a frock coat that looked as if it had probably belonged to his father, made of herringbone with several holes burned into the cuffs. Here you are, he said, as if they had betrayed him by not being in a more easily discovered location. I have come with news. James rose to his feet. What is it, Kit? Those wooden shards you sent me, said Christopher. Thomas and I were able to analyze them using the laboratory in the tavern.
The wooden shards? The ones we thought might be weapons, said Cordelia.
Christopher nodded. The peculiar thing is that the acid that had burned the wood was the blood of some sort of demon, and there was demonic residue on the wood, but only on one side of each shard. James's eyes widened. Say that again. Only on one side of each shard, said Christopher obediently, as if it had been placed there deliberately. No. James reached into his pocket and drew out a folded paper. Cordelia recognized it as the sketch he and Matthew had found at Garst's. He held it out to Cordelia. I meant to ask you before, he said, urgency underlining his tone. I thought when I first glanced at this that they were runes. I don't know what on earth was in my head. Some of these are alchemical symbols, but the others are clearly old Persian writing, probably from the Achaemenid era. Cordelia took the paper from James. She had not been able to look at the paper closely before, but James was right. Below the odd symbols was a name in old Persian. The cuneiform writing did look a bit like runes, but she recognized it immediately. Her mother had insisted she and Alistair know at least a little of the language of Darius the Great. Merthakor, she said slowly. It is a name for a kind of demon that existed in Persia long ago. Shadow hunters call it the Mandakor. Even mundanes have a word for it, James said. Manticore. He glanced over at Christopher. I know what the shards are now, he said. How could I have not seen it before? They are the remains of a Pyxis box. A Pyxis? Cordelia was startled. Long ago, shadow hunters had developed wooden containers called Pyxis boxes to trap the essence of demons they hunted. After the Clockwork War, when Axel Mortmain had used a Pyxis box to transfer demon souls into clockwork monsters, they had been abandoned as a tool by the Nephilim. No one had used them for years. I've seen a Pyxis before, at the Academy, James said. If a demon had been trapped in a Pyxis and burst out, that would explain why there was demon residue only on one side of the wood, the inside. And the markings on the shards resemble the alchemical symbols that were carved on Pyxis boxes. The sound of running footsteps in the hall interrupted him. The door flew open again. This time it was Matthew and Lucy, both looking harried. Christopher, who had seized a seraph blade from his belt, lowered it in relief. Thank Raziel, he said. I thought it was a demon attacking. Matthew gave Christopher a dark look. Put that away, he said. I don't fancy being stabbed. I am far too young and beautiful to die. I see you have been waylaid on your way to find socks, James, said Lucy. Bridget came and told us Christopher was here. What's going on? Has anything happened? Quite a lot of things, actually, said Christopher. We can discuss it all at the Devil Tavern. Thomas is waiting there, and I do not want to leave him alone. The Devil Tavern was a half-timbered building on Fleet Street, with vast glittering window panes that seemed to divide light, leaving the interior of the pub darkly shaded. There were very few people inside, only a few men hunched over tankards of ale, but a grizzled werewolf barkeep and his wide-eyed barmaid watched Lucy, Cordelia, James, Christopher, and Matthew cross the room and ascend the steps, their gazes curious. Cordelia was unsurprised to see that the walls of the Merry Thieves' rooms were crowded with fascinating-looking books. There was an antique-looking dartboard in which several throwing daggers were embedded, its embossed red and black surface showing the marks of many more. There was a corner with sheets of metal fixed to the walls and a sturdy steel-topped work table, upon which sat a set of shiny brass scales and a somewhat battered-looking wooden beer crate filled with test tubes, retorts, and other chemistry paraphernalia. A mobile laboratory for Christopher, Cordelia assumed. A low horsehair sofa was placed directly across from a fireplace, whose mantle boasted a bust of Apollo, below which was carved a verse about wine. Thomas sat upon the sofa, a book in his hand. His broad shoulders were hunched, his eyes shadowed with exhaustion. Still, his face lit up when he saw his friends. "Tom," said James. He went and sank down next to his friend on the worn sofa, placing a hand on his shoulder. He glanced up and saw the others still hesitant. He gestured for them to join him and Thomas. It was always James, Cordelia thought, as they drew up chairs. Always James keeping the group together, noticing when they needed each other. Thomas set down the book he'd been holding. Cordelia was startled to see it was a book of Sufi poetry, the verses of Hafiz and Ibn al-Farid written out in Persian and Arabic. "Cordelia," he said. He sounded weary, as if his voice had been slowed by grief. "Lucy, I'm glad to see you." "Welcome to our sanctum, ladies," said Matthew, unscrewing the cap of his flask. "Christopher salvaged quite a bit of this furniture for us. Like King Arthur and his knights, we prefer to sit at a round table that we might all be equal." "Also," Christopher added, taking a book down from the shelves and handing it to James, "it was the only table my mother was willing to spare." "I couldn't go to Idris," Thomas said rather suddenly, as if someone had demanded of him why he was still in London. "I wish to see Eugenia, but I need to stay here. I need to help Kit find the cure for this demon disease or poison or whatever this is. What happened to my sister cannot happen to someone else." "Sometimes grief and worry must take the form of action," said Cordelia. "Sometimes it is unbearable to sit and wait." Thomas shot her a grateful look. "Exactly that," he said. "So, Christopher told you all about the shards?" "Yes," Christopher interjected. "And James realized the shards are from a Pyxis." "A Pyxis?" Thomas echoed. "But they were destroyed after the Clockwork War. They're unsafe. Remember what happened at school?" "Most Pyxides were destroyed after the Clockwork War," said James. "In Garst's flat, though, I found a drawing. It looked rather like a sketch of an ordinary box. He wasn't a very good artist." "Ah, the drawing with the wobbly runes around it," Matthew said. "They weren't runes," James said. "They were alchemical symbols, the kind you'd carve onto a Pyxis box."
"Oh," said Lucy, "the markings on the shards. They were alchemical symbols too. Of course."
"That wasn't all," said James. "On the paper, Garst had scrawled a word in old Persian. Cordelia was able to translate it." He looked at her expectantly.
"It was a demon's name," Cordelia said. "Merthakor."
She frowned. Such demons had featured in old stories from her childhood. She had always thought of them as near mythical, like dragons. In modern Persian, it would be Mardakor, but shadow hunters call it Amandakor. They are said to be viciously poisonous.
"You think Garst summoned up a Mandakor demon?" Matthew asked. "But aren't they meant to be extinct? And what have they got to do with Pyxis boxes?"
James flipped open the book Christopher had handed him and slid a pair of small gilt reading glasses onto his nose. Something in Cordelia's chest tightened, as if she had snagged a small piece of her heart, like a piece of cloth on a thorn. She looked away from the sight of James and his adorable spectacles.
She had to find someone else to feel this way about, or someone to feel a different way about. Anything, so she could stop feeling like this. She tried not to think about what he had said in the training room. I no longer have an understanding with Grace. But why? What could have happened between them, and happened so quickly? The Mandacore is both here and there, both one and many, James quoted. See, one of the nastiest things about the Mandacore is that it can split itself into many pieces, each of which is both its own separate demon and a part of the original creature. That's why they're best captured in Pyxis boxes. The Mandacore is difficult to kill, partly because it can produce an endless stream of smaller demons. You'd find yourself not even being able to get near it. But with a Pyxis, if you use the box to capture the Mandacore, the smaller demons will disappear. He looked up from the book. I started to guess it was a Pyxis when Christopher told me about the shards. Cordelia's translation confirmed it. I knew Ghast must have summoned up one of the few demons he would need a Pyxis to capture. In this case, a Mandacore. It doesn't look anything like those creatures that attacked us at the park, said Christopher, peering over James's shoulder. The book was illustrated, but Cordelia didn't need to see it. She knew what a Mandacore looked like. Scorpion tail, lion body, triple row of jaws dripping poison. I am fairly sure those were the Kora, offered Cordelia, the smaller demons that split from the Mandacore. They do not resemble it. And that must be why Ghast referred to the demon in the singular. He did raise one demon. It split into smaller demons later. So someone hired Ghast to raise a Mandacore and trap it in a Pyxis, said Lucy. But when he returned to his flat with the demon caged in the box, they ambushed and killed him and set the creature free. Ghast is not the mind behind this, James agreed. He was a tool, useful only for building a Pyxis and summoning the demon. Someone else is directing its movements and attacks. Not just summoning the demon, said Lucy. Remember what Ragnar said. Ghast summoned it in such a way, using dimensional magic, that it is protected from sunlight. They all exchanged glances. Cordelia knew what the others were thinking. Who could have hired Ghast? Was there no motive save to spread bloodshed, contagion, and death? Thomas ran a hand through his thick hair. If the demon were trapped and killed, what of those who were poisoned? Would they get better? James shook his head. The sick will not be healed. We still need an antidote for that. But the demons will be gone, and that is quite a start. He set the book down. The Enclave has been searching for these demons with no success. How would they have guessed they were seeking the offspring of an extinct creature? But now that we know it is a Mandacore. In the stories of Mirthacore demons, they make their homes in between spaces, Cordelia said slowly. For instance, the border between two countries, or the middle of a bridge, somewhere that is neither here nor there. James drew off his spectacles. He was biting his lip thoughtfully. When I went into the Shadow Realm, from the ballroom, he said, I saw, among other things, Tower Bridge. A strange red light poured from it. I think... Matthew sat up straight. We know Ghast raised the demon from a bridge, he said. A place between, as Cordelia said, perhaps it still resides there. So if we were to go to Tower Bridge, with a Pyxis, it's possible that we could recapture the Mandacore, said Lucy. And then the Kora would disappear, just as if it had died. Yes, but we'd have to get a Pyxis first, said Christopher practically. That would be difficult. But perhaps not impossible, said Matthew. He was tapping his fingers restlessly against the arm of his chair, his hair and necktie dishevelled. If most were destroyed after the Clockwork War... A few remain, said James. Unfortunately, they're in Idris.
I was afraid you were going to say that, muttered Matthew, reaching for his flask again. I think it will be noticed by the Clave if we disappear from London and turn up in Idris, rooting around the guard like treasure hunters. James gave him an exasperated look. The only Pixodes in the Clave's possession are in Idris. There are a few others. We just need to find one. There's a certain shop in Limehouse.
Wait, said Cordelia suddenly. A box covered in alchemical symbols. The Ouroboros is an alchemical symbol, isn't it? Matthew, didn't we see a box with a serpent design on it, in the Hell Ruel?
Matthew started.
Yes, he said, in the chamber of Hypatia Vex. A wooden box with an Ouroboros symbol burned into the sides. It makes sense. Hypatia is an inveterate collector.
Excellent, said Christopher. We'll just tell her we need it, then.
Go ahead, if you fancy being turned into a china cabinet, said James. Hypatia does not like shadow hunters.
He looked thoughtful. Good catch, though, Daisy. There must be some way for us to get to it.
We could rob the Hell Ruel, said Thomas. And wear masks, said Lucy eagerly, like highwaymen.
Only a fool would rob Hypatia Vex, said Matthew. And let it not be said that Matthew Fairchild is a fool. At least, let it not be said in my hearing. I would find it very hurtful.
I think Christopher is right, said Cordelia. We should ask Hypatia.
Christopher looked stunned and gratified in equal measure.
We should?
Well, not us, said Cordelia. It is true she does not like most shadow hunters, but there is certainly at least one she likes very much.
Daisy, darling, I'm delighted to see you, Anna declared. Though it is entirely bad form to appear unannounced at tea time. There simply won't be enough cake for everybody. The girls will have cake, and the boys nothing. There is no other fair way to do it.
The flat on Percy Street remained a cheerful oasis of chaos. Perhaps it was even more chaotic than it had been on Cordelia's last visit. A lace-edged ribbon that Cordelia suspected came from a lady's corset adorned one of the knives stuck in Anna's mantelpiece, swinging jauntily from a jewelled hilt. Anna's gold-covered sofa and mismatched chairs were all filled with people. Thomas, too tall for the chairs, was stretched out on the hearth rug with his boots balanced on the coal bucket. On her small table, Anna had laid out, with the air of a magnificent hostess, a fruitcake she called Barmbrack, and a Victoria sponge she'd purchased from a pastry cook's.
That is unjust desserts, said James. The world is unjust, my love, Anna told him.
She sat upon the arm of the high wing-back chair where Christopher was sitting, swinging one booted foot in front of her, and idly reached down to stroke Thomas's hair. The fine strands slipped through her long, scarred fingers.
Of course, I would offer you cake, dear cousin, if I thought it would ease your heart.
Thomas gave her a fond but tired look.
I think in this case, assistance would be better than cake.
By all means, said Anna. Tell me what's going on.
As James explained that they required a pyxis, though not precisely why, implying it was related to the demon attacks, Cordelia looked back and forth between the two cousins, James and Anna. In many ways, the two of them looked more like